Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Now, you can communicate wirelessly with Firecom's wired headsets. No wires or connectors, no cords getting slammed in the door. With our wireless belt packs, the BP3-10 and BP5-10, all Firecom wired headsets can communicate without cords to a base station mounted on the fire emergency apparatus, providing secure, digitally encoded communication. Visit our website at www.firecom.com for more information on our communications equipment.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're taping this show late in the month of September as summer winds down and fall begins to approach, and activities in some departments are beginning to pick up with a little bit of run and a little bit more work as the temperature begins to climb back down the scale. And here's our rundown for today. As usual, we're going to talk about Brother Mike's going to open us up with some recent incidents and accidents with a little bit of commentary here and there on things that we're doing. And being that we're kind of winding down the fire truck show season, so to speak, with the conclusion here in the last month or so of the Fire Rescue International and the New Jersey show and a couple of other fairly good-sized regional shows up, Brother Mike and I thought it would be appropriate to talk about things we do to screw up fire trucks. Now, this is not relegated to any one geographic area of the country, certainly not meant against any department or manufacturer, but we're going to talk about some things that Mike and I have seen over the course of this year, and some of these have been out there for a while, but now these seem to be coming in more prominence, and this might be the type of thing that, as they say at the beginning of some of the Law and Order episodes, this program might not be for all listeners. So some parental discretion is advised here. If your department has done some of these things, well, we may upset you, but we're going to give you our opinion on things and how we tend to take a safe apparatus that's in compliance with 1901 and kind of just make it more difficult to operate off of. And then we're going to finally get to some very excellent questions that have been sent in by our listeners and respond back to them and finish up at the end of the podcast with talking about a little bit of a little mini industry update. So, Brother Mike, how are you today? And before we get into what I think will become one of our most favorite discussions, what do we do to screw up fire trucks? What have the brothers and sister firefighters been doing out there, out in the field with some recent accidents here in the last couple of weeks?
Hello, Brother Tom, and hello to all of our faithful listeners. We start out with what now everybody knows was a double line of duty death. It was a vehicular wildfire accident. Two firefighters basically were in smoke conditions trying to flee a fire and a wildfire, and they drove off the road, which ended up being a cliff, and they fell about 800 feet, and they were both killed, and it was later determined that fire was an arson fire. It was a large fire, and that the police are now looking for suspects, not only for the arson, but for the murder of those two firefighters. We move on to the state of Pennsylvania, where there was an aerial collapse at a fire in Montehiela, Pennsylvania. A firefighter was belted on the tip of a light-duty pre-1991 100-foot aerial ladder. The truck was flowing water at what looked to be a block-type fire. The feeder line going up this light-duty ladder appeared to be 4-inch, if not 4-inch, it was certainly 3.5, and it was larger than what the truck was designed for. The truck was being operated at an extremely low angle, almost fully extended. In some of the pictures that are on the internet, you can see the truck was fairly far up in the air, and then somebody chose to lower the truck down to an angle of about, appeared 20 degrees. And then we were led to believe that the water was then shut off, the waterway was shut off, and basically it was the back pressure of the water that was holding the truck up. The ladder failed. There was a firefighter that was belted in on the tip, and he was not seriously hurt, not by anything skillful done by anybody, but just by the grace of God and a lot of luck, he survived. Because the ladder was at such a low angle, he really didn't fall. It appeared to be all that far from the pictures that were provided on the internet. And what I found troubling, we went to Dave Statter's website to look up some of this. He had a thread going on his blog, and the lack of knowledge of some firefighters in and around this equipment is certainly troubling, if not truly scary. One firefighter wrote in that he had not taken a ladder class in a while, but the last one that he did take, he kind of remembered that the ladder should not be over the cab of the truck or over the rear of the truck, which is just simply not true. If you look at the construction of the trucks, that can be the safest and strongest place for the ladder to be, is centered over the cab or over the chassis. So we just don't know what we don't know. Any comment, Tom, on that?
Yeah, Mike, the scenario surrounding the failure of that ladder truck was something that was, you know, fairly common, if not predominant, of a combination of circumstances where you had a unit built prior to the 91 standard when there were requirements for the minimum tip load rating of 250 pounds, the unit operating at or near full extension at an angle of elevation certainly below nominally what you would want to have for a ladder pipe operation of something in the area of, you know, 65 to 75 degrees was operating well below 45, right? With a ladder pipe, a charged supply line going up the ladder pipe, and not one but two firefighters at the tip of the device. I guess the part that takes me back about this particular incident, and as you said, Michael, by the grace of God, no one was seriously, you know, injured in this case, is that you would think that at this stage in our fire service careers and histories that we would not allow a set of circumstances like that to occur, no matter how valiant and or, you know, if you wanted to, certainly not going to use the word heroic in this case, but how valiant the efforts may have been to try to contain the fire, you know, in whatever was burning by using the ladder pipe, but to use the device in a functioning capacity that it clearly was not designed to operate in any fashion, even if the unit was brand new off the factory floor and we could, you know, go back in time and say that the unit's a week old, you know, fresh out of the factory. It happened to be a Maxim aerial, which was a pretty well-built aerial device for its time and its age. If you did that same thing when the unit was 4 weeks old, the circumstances would have been predictable, you know, and where some people, as you mentioned on the blogs, were, you know, noting the, you know, the age of the unit and the fact that had it been inspected, you know, all that stuff is maybe relevant to a point. But if you allow yourself to be put in a precarious situation like that, thinking that you're taking the vehicle well beyond its design limitations, as your comment, you know, went, Mike, which is very appropriate, you don't know what you don't know until you've been exposed to it in some fashion. And to me, it's I would wager there's probably more departments out there that, given the circumstances, you know, they'd probably go out and try to accomplish the same type of tactic by employing the vehicle in what, by any stretch of the imagination, people would look at as a completely unsafe manner. And beyond that, just have to say I'm speechless. I don't know what else to say.
Well, thank you for your comments and your commentary, Brother Tom. We continue on with the news of the day. There's a new video out, a second video that shows a different angle of the rally tiller crash. There are two videos, one that was taken by a city bus that was following the vehicle that was kind of grainy, but you kind of got the point. One that was much more clear was on a traffic camera that saw them flip the vehicle over as well. Thankfully, again, nobody was hurt in that crash. Major reason there is that everybody was buckled in. One of the things to note is that the tiller enclosure went away fairly quickly, and this is one of several incidents in the recent past involving tractor-drawn aerials, and it's my understanding that at an interim meeting of 1901, Brother Tom, that particular facet of apparatus construction was discussed?
Yeah, I believe, Mike, that it was discussed. I'm not sure whether it was at a 1901 meeting or at a Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association meeting, which is an independent organization of apparatus builders and component suppliers. But the topic was brought up, and I know at one level or the other, there's a task group that's going to be looking at developing some standard criteria for the design of a tiller cab. Without going into a lot of details, most tiller cabs were designed kind of more for fit, form, and function, as to make it easier for the tillerman to access and egress out of the tiller cab, to improve his visibility, to put some creature comforts back there if you're out in the desert southwest and people run tillers. It's kind of important. You got to have air conditioning back there. If you're operating up here where Mike and I live in the northeast, you got to have a pretty hefty blower system back there for the heater. So more of it had to do with creature comforts than it had to do with the structural integrity and the crash-worthiness, so to speak, of the tiller cab, because most people didn't expect the tiller cab to be riding down the road on its side or on its roof, which if you look closely at the photos of the tiller cab and how it deformed post-accident, to me, Michael, it was somewhat reminiscent of some of the photos that you have accumulated over the years of commercial cabs and chassis in rollover incidents. So the safe to say the industry as a whole, both the industry and the regulatory body, the NFPA, the 1901 parent committee, is going to be looking at that here in the very near future to look and see if we can improve some of the designs that are out there currently.
Good. Thank you for that update, Tom. We continue on now. There were 11 people hurt in London, England, in a fire apparatus crash that occurred, believe it or not, on September 11th of this year. It happened just before 9 o'clock British Standard Time. A car was flipped onto its side and ended up against a building wall. There was an injured man, two women, and two girls inside of that, and then five firefighters and the driver of a taxi cab were also injured. Pennsylvania ambulance driver was arrested for DUI following a crash. A volunteer ambulance driver was arrested in Pennsylvania on suspicion of driving under the influence of alcohol after the ambulance was driving, crashed over the weekend while transporting a patient to the hospital. And I have a big problem with this. I think it is one of the coolest things that man can do to man. Here we have somebody that is not feeling well or has been traumatized by an incident or an accident that is in the back of an ambulance. And prior to getting into the back of that ambulance, they may be feeling like they may not survive, or they're probably in a great degree of mental anguish or discomfort. And then all of a sudden, we show up in an ambulance, and we strap them to the gurney, and we put them back in the ambulance. And what happens, do you think, Tom, to that person as they enter the back of that ambulance? What do you think that their mental outlook changes and becomes?
Well, I don't know. I've fortunately never found myself in that particular position, but my thought would be that people are maybe whatever angst they're feeling is like, okay, the first responders, the emergency personnel are here, and things, you know, at least I'm going to a place where I'm going to be taken care of. I'm out of, if you were involved in a car accident or a crash or some other incident, it's like you've removed yourself from that scenario, and now you're in somewhat of a, your mindset, I'm somewhat in a safe zone here, or would hope that you're not anticipating that, as in this particular case, that the man was out, the driver was out popping a few before he decided to come pick you up.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point from this. Here we have basically let our vulnerability shine, and we've let our guard down. What was once a sickness or a trauma, first responders have showed up. We have gotten onto the gurney, and with that comes a sense of comfort and reassurance by the first responders. And then we violate, and what it becomes, man's inhumanity to man. We violate that trust, that unspoken trust. We violate that contract that we have with that patient, and we wreck them. And then when the operator is suspected of being DUI, all the more sense of outrage and disgust that somebody would do that. And we teach about this, we talk about it, you and I. If you are a volunteer and you have had any alcohol or any over-the-counter drugs or any drugs, stay home. We don't need you. Your liability is too much. The damage that you could do to civilians, to yourself, to your family, to the organization, to fellow firefighters and first responders, it's just not worth it. So in your volunteer spare time, if you've had a few pops, you're out in the back at a barbecue, we're coming up on the holiday season, you go to a party and the pager goes off, stay home. Stay where you are. We just simply don't need you. We don't need the liability and the risk and the discredit that you could bring to the service. We move on now. A Georgia fire apparatus strikes a police car. In Rome, Georgia, a police car and a Quint collided last night while responding to a call. The Rome police unit and the Quint were looking for a house where a man apparently injured from some fallen tree limbs in his yard. The police car was turning around when the Quint hit the police cruiser on the driver's side. The police car received major damage to both side doors, and the fire apparatus had minor damage. So we have police versus fire. And then the next day, we have a fire apparatus operator that's accused of forcing an ambulance off the road while they're responding to the same call in New Jersey. They were both responding to a car crash. It is alleged that that a fire truck passed an ambulance headed to the same scene. And what's interesting is I've gone around and taught, I've seen where a police car passed a fire truck, again going to the same accident scene, and there's just no reason or need for it. One service is certainly not better than the other. We're all going to help, and this kind of attitude and nonsense really has to stop. Now, of course, the fire department has one kind of story that they're telling for this, and then the ambulance has something totally different that they're telling, and we'll leave that up to the police and the courts to work that out. But just suffice it to say that if we get involved in things like that and ultimately we wreck like they did in Rome, Georgia, then nobody shows up and nobody can help. And the taxpayers that pay the freight and buy equipment and apparatus and in some cases pay salaries deserves better than that. Go ahead, Tom.
Mike, just to make a comment on that, there were some things posted on various websites, as you alluded to, in the case of New Jersey, where the one organization was making the claim and the, you know, the ambulance group was making a claim and the fire department was making a counterclaim. But if you just take it at face value, it's two emergency service provider organizations trying to operate safely and sanely at the scene of a singular incident. And it goes to the comment that the little scenario that Mike had that, you know, you might sit back and laugh if it wasn't your department or the Quint hitting the hitting the police car. But we have to realize that while we think in the fire service that we on our own may be the more powerful organization, anytime we operate in an incident, it's chances are there's going to be more than just your organization operating in a multi-organizational or potentially in a large event, a multi-jurisdictional event. And if you haven't played well with those people on a tabletop scenario or talking about SOPs or SOGs, we in the fire service for years, and Mike and I have loads of great pictures of a police car blocking a fire hydrant, and we laugh and make fun of it over what we would do and all that stuff. But if we haven't worked with our brothers in arms to explain to them what we do and how we're going to operate when we go out to do the real thing, and we haven't practiced that and talked through it where the uniform services at the street level and, more importantly, at the command level know what the expectations of the other organization is going to be, then we're going to continue to have these kinds of incidents. And again, where, you know, the Quint wiping out the side of the police car because they were both looking for the same thing, you know, that maybe didn't have anything to do with the lack of training or discussion there. But what would have happened, for example, if you were coming into a one-way street block or a dead-end cul-de-sac where your department is going to be working on a first alarm basis with the next department and you both meet at that intersection at the same time, who does what? Now we got a fire truck on fire truck accident, and we've already had enough of those, Brother Mike, as you've you know, talked about earlier in the year. So I think it's maybe time for us, particularly since we're approaching, at least out here in the East, the kind of colder months where you're looking for some other things to do. If you haven't played or had any kind of exercise with, if your EMS provider is a separate organization from the fire department in just about all cases. I think I was only in one place this year in Michigan where the police and the fire department were the same agency, that it was a public safety agency. But more often than not, those are two different distinct organizations. Might be time to sit down and break bread with the folks and make sure that we're on the proverbial same sheet of music. If we're not, then things like this are going to continue to happen. And while there was, you know, so you almost say, you know, no harm, no foul, other than the damaged police car here. You know, an ambulance passing a fire truck or a police car passing a fire truck or vice versa on a public highway, number one, is nonsensical. There's no reason for it. It doesn't look good. When this kind of stuff hits the press, now the public is out there and our shorts are out there now hanging on the flagpole with people trying to decide, making their own minds up over who's, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. Well, we need to have our act together. And with that, Michael, I'll get off my soapbox.
Thank you, Brother Tom, for those comments. We continue on with just a few more items. A couple weeks ago, one person was killed and three were injured in a Tennessee ambulance accident. There seems to be, in this month at least, a propensity for a high amount of EMS ambulance-type accidents. A car and a fire apparatus responding to a fire collided. She allegedly lost control of her vehicle and collided with a fire apparatus in the state of Washington. And the Washington State Highway Patrol reported that drugs or alcohol were probably going to end up being a factor in this case, in this crash with that civilian. One would only have to look on the news in the last couple of days as we head, like Brother Tom said, towards the end of September in a terrible severe flooding in the southeastern part of the country, particularly in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And you can go to our website at www.emergencyvehicleresponse.com and see pictures of a house on fire surrounded by water and a pumper from a fire department that's almost completely underwater with the exception of its hose bed top and the roof. In Winnipeg, Canada, a day ago, a Winnipeg fire department had some firefighters injured at a working house fire when a connection blew off the engine company and the operator took the full force of that LDH in his chest. Two other firefighters were injured when they tried to catch him, and they all ended up in the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries but some possible fractures. There's an update from the state of Ohio. If you recall, there was a very serious crash about 18 months ago in Maslin, Ohio, where a female firefighter driving a Quint on the way to a car fire struck a minivan and killed two occupants of that minivan, which ended up being woodpile relations to the driver of that Quint. In his follow-up, there is now obviously a lawsuit that's being taken on. It just broke the other day in the news. It claimed that reckless driving by the firefighter caused a crash, and a wrongful death lawsuit has been filed. Both the officer and the driver have been named in the suit. The last thing, of course, we know is that this firefighter or the officer or anyone on any FD wants to be involved in a crash like this. Like all of us, their intent was to do good. By passing this info along, we hope that it will give all the drive apparatus a pause to just take a minute and just think before you put your foot to the floor and drive in a code response. This is truly, it may be one of the biggest tragedies that I've ever seen in all my years of doing this. I thought I had seen everything until we end up somebody kills one of their own relatives in a fire truck crash. Just a tragedy for the department members involved and for the victims' families, and just truly, truly sad how it's gone and where it's going to continue to go. And prayers go out to all those involved, really and truly. And a couple, you can't make these up. An L.A. water main break. An L.A. engine company was responding to a water main break, a sinkhole, when a block before the address it was given, they actually fell in one and pretty much buried that cab. And then the last, you really, really can't make this one up. A fire apparatus collided with a helicopter in Iowa. This helicopter landed at an accident scene in a medevac situation. The fire truck was leaving the scene, and as they went to leave the scene to go on another call, they hit the helicopter. And you can't make this up, Brother Tom.
Well, Mike, that leads us into probably what will be another equally good you can't make this up over coming into our next thing of things we do to screw up our fire apparatus. And this was something that just got circulated between Brother Mike and myself and a couple of our compatriots here in the last day or so. Some enterprising fire department down south, we won't identify the name of the department or the state and to give away the location, took a school bus chassis, modified it, cut off the back portion, maybe the back half, call it, of the shell of the school bus, and mounted a water tank on the back. So we had now turned the school bus into basically a combination personnel carrier and water tender. Clearly looked like it was done like a homemade job, and the our good friend, the chief of the College Park Fire Department down in Maryland, had sent this around with the comment saying, I guess these people hadn't heard of the NFPA. And I first thought it was a Photoshop. job. But and looking at it, it's like, nope, lo and behold, they took this school bus chassis and made it and turned it into a water tender. Now, there's been several studies out there. One that was done and published by NIOSH and some other organizations regarding the safe operation of apparatus and water tenders, in that these units just have a high preponderance for getting involved in accidents for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that many of these units are built without any regard to the NFPA or any other type of highway standards, because they're basically built homemade and home-built units. If your department, I understand that with the economy, even before the economy tanked, to our listeners, that money's tight, fire departments have to figure out how to do more with less. But if your department is put in a situation that you cannot even afford to buy a used water tanker, tender, whatever the local term might be, then drop us a line at Mike's website, and we'll do everything we can to try to help you locate one, get somebody to donate something to you. But if you're running around in a school bus chassis trying to haul water, that is an accident waiting to happen. It's either going to happen to the driver and have an involvement, or some other poor unsuspecting civilian that sees this thing goes by and what was once painted yellow is now painted red with emergency warning lights. And I'll guarantee you that chassis, from the frame rails to any part of the suspension componentry system to any of the even 1991 recommended NFPA safety related aspects, were not included on that school bus chassis. And to run around in that on a with a water tank is it's just beyond description. Or as I had sent out with the with my comments on it, it said, brings new meaning to the expression, we're riding the short bus. So with that, things we do to screw up fire trucks, and we're going to start with things that have upset Brother Mike on aerial ladders. And we're first going to start with the color of the aerial device itself. And here's a little background, right? Back in the day when people, you know, aerial towers were just starting to come into prominence in the 70s, kind of took off in the 80s. The ladder truck of the day in the 70s was a mid-mount aerial of some description, and if you had a lot of money, you had a snorkel. And your ladder truck, typically the ladder sections were painted gray or navy gray or gunmetal gray. And snorkel booms kind of stood out because they were painted white. Well, if you were in a community that had two ladder trucks, you had an aerial device was painted gray and one that was painted white, the next time you replaced that ladder truck, when you replaced it in the 80s or maybe even the early 90s, chances are now that aerial device now got painted white because you wanted it to match the roof of the cab or the snorkel device or your tower device. Well, now, the segue for Brother Mike, we have found that there are other colors in the rainbow beyond gray and white. And, Mike, what have you seen this year?
Well, Tom, it goes back to a ladder class that I did in a suburb of Houston, Texas. And nobody will deny that an aerial ladder or a tower ladder painted black with a black roof, raised roof, and red over black is just not anything short of stunning as far as looks for fire apparatus. But we took the aerial ladder, it was a 107-foot aerial, and we put it up out in back of the station. And even though it had the new track lighting that goes up inside of the beams inside by the rungs, that was blue, and again, very distinguishing, certainly easy on the eye. By the time we got the ladder up to the 50-foot mark, it was difficult, even with the lights, to see exactly where the ladder was in relationship to anything else. And by the time we got this black ladder to the 75-foot mark, you just frankly could not see anything at all. And forget about putting it up 107-foot. And we were out in the back of the firehouse just practicing training with the piece. It wasn't in the fire, in the smoke, in the heat, in the dark. It was in the dark, but it wasn't with any of the excitement that goes along with a good first due fire, with people hanging out the windows and the chief barking orders and all that. And I think it's only a matter of time before one of these trucks ends up into the wires or into the trees and somebody gets seriously hurt. There's just nothing to judge off of, and there's no contrast with the black ladder and black at night. And again, I don't care how much in the way of light you put on it, you just can't simply see to operate the vehicle safely. And so that is one of my pet peeves. The second, and I just got done doing a ladder class this past week. They had a mid-mounted tower, and they had a tractor-drawn aerial. And people continue to want to put stuff, a.k.a. Stokes baskets, portable ladders, on the outside of these aerial devices, air tanks, these coffin-style boxes, and all of these things block the vision between the operator and the tip of the aerial, in the case of an aerial, or blocks the operator from seeing personnel in the basket and to properly operate the piece. It's like operating the piece blind. And in each one of the classes that I did this past week with this tractor-drawn aerial and this mid-mounted tower, the operators were, their heads were almost at a 90-degree angle to their bodies, trying to look around all the crap that's on the side of the ladder. And again, it just makes, and particularly with the ladder boxes, I'll walk up the ladder and look in the ladder boxes that are along the side, those 3 foot by 4 foot deep by, you know, 8 foot long coffin boxes, and go up and look inside of them and find that there's nothing in them. So you got to wonder, it's like you got to take your favorite quote, you need a sanity check here and figure out what these folks were thinking. But the bottom line is that the apparatus operator, you wouldn't drive a fire truck or you wouldn't drive anything with an air bottle or a portable ladder in the way. Well, we shouldn't allow firefighters to spec all of this stuff on the side of their aerials and expect any kind of safe, good end result at the end of the day. Again, it's only a matter of time before somebody gets seriously hurt or killed because the operator can't see what he's doing.
Well, Mike, it brings up one other point, just going back to the ladder paint issue. You happen to mention black because that is one of the more common things of what people have been doing. And it started out, I suspect, I'm not sure, you know, but probably kind of started out with people wanting to emulate the color scheme of what the city of Chicago has used on their apparatus for years of black over red, and black became one of the alternate colors that people started being to paint aerial devices. Mike and I have already also seen them, although they are rarer, but we've had rear mount towers painted a royal blue color. There's several out there that are painted red or different shades of red. The issue becomes if you're painting the ladder in a color scheme that is dark and is going to make it difficult for you to be able to observe the tip of the aerial device, then you're potentially designing something that is going to be tough, if not dangerous, to use. And while we will all agree that it looks nice, here's the commentary, and again, we'll put it out there. This might not be for all listeners. If you're buying your fire truck to look good, to win trophies in a parade, or to look cool, or to outdo your next-door neighbor, then you might want to downsize the size of that vehicle and buy it just for your parades, and then go buy a vehicle that you're going to be able to use effectively at structural fires. And lastly, I mean, if you look at jurisdictions that routinely use their aerials in an offensive manner, in a manner to be able to support other operations that the truck guys and the engine folks are doing, and I would challenge the listeners, you can go to any department, East Coast to West Coast, from San Francisco to L.A. County to L.A. City, over to FDNY, any place in between, all right? You haven't found any of these very active departments that use their aerial devices all the time. You haven't seen any of those people painting them an alternate color because they think it's better. If you look at what other folks are doing, I think we can glean an awful lot over what people do. And it's not because we've actually seen posts up on some of the websites, people wanting to know how much more it would cost to paint the ladder black because they think that looks neat. Whatever you do, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, do not be buying your ladder truck and painting it in a different color so it looks neat, because it might look neat, but it's not going to work very well when you go to operate it on fire ground. So, all right, so we've had Brother Mike talk about a couple of things that he thinks things are doing that kind of screw up fire apparatus. Well, now it's Tom's turn. And this particular item has been out there for a while. People have been using the front bumper space on rescue trucks and rescue engines, or whatever you want to call them, for some time. And 4 or 5 years ago, it was the comment that I turned, it's the last bastion of space on a fire truck that we figured out how to screw it up. So we've gone for a typical rescue truck would normally have a maybe 16 to 18-inch bumper extension on an older vehicle, maybe had a front-mounted winch, a couple of small little storage compartments. If your rescue truck had a small fire pump or some kind of suppression capabilities, you may have also had a trash line on the front bumper, you know, with a hose well, and hey, that was great. And you fit all of that in 16, 18, maybe 20 inches. Somewhere along the line, somebody's going to take credit for it. The very first person decided, well, let's put a rescue tool up on the front bumper. And with the rescue tool came initially an outlet. Then shortly thereafter, we had a single hydraulic hose reel. Now we have double hydraulic hose reels, or a hydraulic hose reel and a electric cable reel and an enclosed full-width tread plate cover to cover all of this stuff. And we've got our hydraulic rescue tool up there, thinking that on rescue vehicles, it's infinitely easier to kind of nose in to the incident, and it just makes it so much easier to be able to deploy your pre-connected tool. That very well may be the case, but that comes at a cost, and comes at a significant cost if your vehicle gets in an accident. All right. Now the bumper extensions, instead of being 18 to 20 inches, now they're between 24 to 30. I've seen them as big as 34 inches of bumper out in front of the apparatus, that now we have lighted bumper guidons to be able to know where these things are when we're trying to maneuver around in tight situations. If you take the cost of the hose reels, the hydraulic or electric reels, and the cost of the tools and everything you've got up on the front bumper, now instead of having a winch and maybe a couple of compartments that cost that $2,500, now we got anywhere between $8,000 to maybe $10,000, $12,000 worth of stuff sitting out on that extended front bumper that in many cases either A, hasn't been properly protected, it's not reinforced, the builder just extended it out 30 inches instead of extending it out 18 inches with no more gusset work or framework, so it's not any stronger than it normally would be. You've now got that additional foot or foot and a half of space to have to contend with, and people will say, I'm trying to design a vehicle as short as possible, and Brother Mike will get a charge out of this, right? I'm trying to design this rescue pumper to be as short as possible, but we need to have two reels and a tool on a front bumper, and I have to have a top mount pump with speed lays. Well, that's kind of like telling me you got a quarter acre of property and you're just trying to build a modest house, but by the way, you know, you need to have 5 bedrooms and 3 baths, you know, to house the family. The two of them just don't go together. So if you're going to do all of that, at the very least, have the bumper properly protected and supported, maybe consider a steel reinforced, you know, a steel bumper that's certainly reinforced with appropriate framework that comes out to support the ends of the bumper. So if you get involved in a little fender bender, that bumper is not going to fold in and take out your $2,600 hydraulic reel, or maybe do damage to the hydraulic rescue tool. In addition, pay some attention to how it's all enclosed, because while you can put a very fancy, nice-looking one-piece, two-piece, or three-piece tread plate cover over the front bumper enclosure, chances are, and unless it's designed properly, it's not going to be weather-tight or weatherproof. If it's got a hinge, you can't make a hinge weatherproof. So you need to pay some attention to how you're going to design all of this. Better off, you might just be thinking that if you're going to be taking $8,000 or $10,000 worth of stuff, maybe putting it on the front bumper and making your fire truck a foot and a half longer is not the best thing for you. You know, you might want to think about locating it in the body compartments and properly protecting it and just deploy the equipment out of that. So, Mike, there's my little rant on that. We continue to make fire trucks bigger and bigger, and then we wonder why they don't maneuver around or why we get involved in these little fender benders and stuff, or it looked good, again, looked good just like with our black ladder truck. Looks sharp as hell going straight right down the center of the road on the Memorial Day or the Labor Day parade. It doesn't work very well when you're trying to get into tight, dimly lit, you know, conditions when the area and the scenario that we have to deal with is less than favorable. So, Mike, any comment on that before we launch into the next one?
Well, again, we've seen an uptick in just minor accidents, and what occurs with these large front bumper extensions, you go to the chimney fire or the flue fire, and you go up Mrs. Jones's driveway, and you bring the incident to a successful conclusion, and now all of a sudden you have to back this bad boy out of Mrs. Jones's driveway. And, of course, we know that you are supposed to be looking in the mirrors when you back up at your spotter. As you are looking at your mirrors to back up and looking at your spotter, you come to the end of the driveway where you have to turn either left or right, and all of a sudden we're taking out Mrs. Jones's mailbox, some white roadway poles, or maybe the guardrail, or maybe even bumping into a utility pole, and where it used to be no harm or no foul, we're now taking out, you know, the warning light that's embedded in the front bumper, and then we're doing damage to any of the plumbing or any of the reels and the hydraulic tools that the particular fire department happened to have the vendor put in their front bumper. And so there's some driver training issues there, some training issues, and then, of course, there's some specification issues as well. And I, too, like you, we've taken a really great idea of installing some things on the front bumper, and we've turned it over time into a bad idea. About the only thing I haven't seen on the front bumper yet is the Ladyville Auxiliary with a coffee pot making coffee for us, and who knows, maybe somebody's got that under construction as we speak.
All right, and here's our last little rant before we take a quick break. And this has to do with if you're designing any kind of vehicle. Probably less important on aerial devices, because there's already some designs in most people's area to be able to climb, to get from the ground up to the turntable, the ground up to the top of the portion of the body, in a reasonably safe manner, because they use wide steps and looping type handrails. If you're going up the back of a pumper, or particularly even more important on a rescue pumper where we've got full height, full depth compartments in the back, across the rear is flat, so it does not have traditional beaver tails with handrails going up them, and we're relying upon steps, particularly folding steps. And Mike and I fully realize You can build a vehicle completely in compliance with 1901, and I would say I'd still defy you to be able to safely get up and down the back of that unit without potentially slipping and falling off the unit. The NFPA mandates that the first step from the ground to the first step can't exceed 24 inches, and then every other step cannot exceed 18 inches. The steps have criteria for non-slip, for slip resistance. They have to be lit, and there has to be a handrail there. We have seen innumerable cases, however, this past year, and looking at what people have purchased, and look at a flatback design on a rescue pumper, and have to have safely ascend a total of no less than 5 folding steps that are either staggered or, worse yet, directly in line with one another to be able to get up to the top of the vehicle. So if you're designing your vehicle with topside locker or coffin-style compartments, at some point consider you're going to have to get up there. If you're designing anything, any type of engine, where you've got supply line or attack line beds, at some point you're going to have to go up there and repack them after you lay out. So give some thought without using folding steps to use either wider thick steps, to use access type ladders similar to what you'd see on the back of an aerial device where they're actually wide steps and can be angled out with looping type handrails, or either a custom built or there's a couple of commercially available pull out style, people call them probably pool ladders for lack of a better description, right, that you can use to safely ascend, and better yet, to be able to climb back down off the apparatus, right? Brother Mike and I are on a mission. If you don't listen to anything else that we talk about, all right, is look at the safety of your operating personnel on or about your rigs. And you don't have to be in the market for a brand new fire truck to figure out how to make your fire truck safer. You can do that without a whole lot of work by just critically looking at the unit, taking a look at it, the NFPA standard, take a look and evaluate some of the things that Mike and I have either spoke about on podcast, written about in our column in Firehouse Magazine, and imploring you to look at your units and to make them safer. Slips, falls, sprains, and strains continue to be the number one fire ground injury, and a lot of cases it's due to people operating on or about the rig. So let's really try to give some thought to designing apparatus that we can operate on and off of safely once we get there safely with all the other things that we've got to worry about. All right, we're going to take a quick break. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, and our monthly podcast. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
No wires, no plugs, just crystal clear, mission-critical communication with Firecom's wireless headset and base station. First responders are able to connect to the in-cab intercom system and vehicle radios with critical on-scene communication using the wireless headset. Firecom's headset is ideal for command vehicles, on-scene first responders, and ambulance attendants. Visit www.firecom.com for more information on their products.
Hey, we're back. It's Mike Wilbur, Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, and right now we're going to go into some questions received from our listeners, and we're going to try our best here to give some lucid commentary and some things that maybe you can take away. So go ahead, Mike. What do you got? What's first up?
Well, Tom, I got a couple of brain teasers for you to try and exercise your mind a little bit. The first comes from our state, the great state of New York. Lieutenant Wilbur, recently our city hired a new municipal insurance company to perform an overall risk assessment of all departments. This was done to identify potential areas where liability could be an issue. While our department, the fire department, fared pretty well, our repair shop at the DPW was nipped due to none of the mechanics having any certifications to work on emergency vehicles. I think they are referring to the EVT certification. A heated discussion between our mayor and DPW superintendent regarding this issue came up at the last department head meeting. I intervened and offered to check further and to help out. It goes on to say that the lead mechanic for the DPW has been very well trained as far as handling fire apparatus. He's had fire pump training, and he's been trained on most other fire apparatus systems, and the fire chief who wrote this letter determined that he was getting excellent service out of his DPW. In any event, with this excellent program in place, he painted this picture that, you know, do you feel it's necessary for our mechanics to become EVT certified for liability purposes, even though they have this great program in place, and he feels he's getting more than adequate and up-to-date work done on his fire trucks. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, Mike, that's a great question. So before we launch into the response, just a couple of out-of-the-box thoughts. One is that it's heartening to me that this chief has got a great relationship with his DPW and he's getting good service. That is not what you hear more often than not when you're out on the street and you get to the subject of apparatus maintenance. Today, with the way the economy is, and we'll keep beating up on that theme probably until it straightens around, hopefully sooner rather than later for all of us and our listeners, that if it's determined that you cannot get your unit fixed using your local community municipal resources and you have to send it out to an outside shop, particularly if it's a shop that does strictly fire apparatus work, and people sometimes gag at what the cost of those repairs are, understand that those outside independent shops have to have personnel that are EVT certified, and that is a cost of doing business, which ultimately has got to get passed on to us, you know, the fire service consumers. So understand that that certification involves various levels of training, and it takes some time. You just don't go in and take a test. It's unlike taking the SATs for college. You sit down, you take a three-hour test, you come out and go, woohoo, I'm EVT certified. There are different levels in different disciplines based on the various components. For example, electrical versus engine versus braking systems on apparatus, and it is a series of tests that one has to take. And again, that doesn't come for free. The first word of advice to go to the chief specifically is that if you are going to use, and it's certainly fine, use your local resources. Two words of advice. One is that I would make sure that your apparatus maintenance program is in compliance with NFPA 1911, which is the document, the standard for the inspection, maintenance, testing, and retirement of in-service apparatus. That's kind of like the starting point. It doesn't make any difference whether you're getting those resources from your community or getting them from an outside agency. You want to make sure your apparatus is compliant with that standard. But specifically within that standard, on page 13, under section 4.3 of qualifications of personnel, right, it states the following, among several other things. Any person performing diagnostic checks, inspections, or maintenance of the apparatus shall meet the qualifications of NFPA, here's another standard, 1071, the standard for emergency vehicle technician professional qualifications, or the equivalent. Now, or the equivalent, let's speak to what this chief mentioned, that he said his person was not EVT certified, but he had other qualifications. There are several areas where you can get training, typically at no cost to the community other than your cost of transportation and your lodging to get there. The people that built your fire truck, all right, if it has a certain brand of pump, whether it's Hale, Waterous, Darley, all three of those pump manufacturers offer annual, at least annual, if not semi-annual, training schools to become certified to how to work and maintain that make and model of fire pump. That comes free of charge. If you own one of those, you just need to pay your way to get there, and typically then for your lodging and your meals. You can get similar training if you have an aerial device built by one of the manufacturers, and you can get trained on how to maintain that aerial device, the hydraulic system, the electrical components, and everything. It's not going to train you how to operate it, all right, on the fire ground. That's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to accomplish teaching you how to diagnose issues and what the maintenance intervals need to be on the aerial device. And most of the major manufacturers also offer service schools that cover basics over their electrical system. So if your mechanic has attended those, he's at least has certificates to indicate that he received that training. If he hasn't received that training, you certainly want to avail him of that. The last statement that it makes under that section 4.3, Mike, it says the authority having jurisdiction shall determine who is qualified to perform the daily, weekly inspection and operational checks of the fire apparatus. So that can include your volunteer members, your career staff. It can include the mechanic, depending upon how you have your maintenance program established. So while emergency vehicle technician training certainly is the ultimate goal of what you would want to have your organization strive for, right, in that case, there are other intermediate levels of training. And save the fact to say, well, this gentleman, and this is the oversimplification, but what you hear sometimes, you know, one day the guy's working on a garbage truck, the next day he's working on my fire truck. Okay, well, that very well may be the case in a DPW situation. I'd expect that to be the case. If the person has training and certified training and can document that, and you're maintaining your apparatus in compliance with 1911, I think you're in good shape. If you don't do anything until it breaks, and your local mechanic may be well-known and the pillar of the community but has no training or certification behind him, you need to get him that training or certification or look to have your units done on the outside or by some agency. And here's a last little quick comment. There's a lot of departments, particularly, again, given the economy, they don't have the time or the resources to have the apparatus maintenance done in-house with their own resources. Sometimes they contract that service out to an adjacent fire department where they have that level of maintenance personnel. And there's a number of jurisdictions that they run their fire department maintenance shop as a independent for-profit operation that you can avail yourself, depending on where you are geographically, of course, to have your apparatus brought there where their people are all EVT certified to the various different levels. So very complex question, not so easy on the answers, but sounds to me like they've got a good system there. They need to ensure that their man has at least the proper certification training for the basic components that are on the apparatus that they run, and if they don't, then you can get that training at a pretty nominal cost. So, okay, Mike, there's the first one. So pitch one, I'd say, maybe got a single on that. Okay, so the next pitch is coming down a pipe. What do you got for me?
Okay. Dear Lieutenant Wilbur, when specifying axles on our new truck, I feel based on the equipment we carry and the need to have proper braking capabilities, we should stick with a 31,000 rear rather than a 31,000 rear and a 21,000 front as our last two heavy rescue pumpers were. Your thoughts? A couple of bidders feel that 27,000 and 18,000 on the front respectively would be fine.
Okay, and this one, because I like some baseball analogies, this one, I'm going to lay down a simple little bunt, and we're going to push that guy from first base over to second base. So here's the response. Great question again, right? Really can't say what axle you need until you determine how much weight you're going to put on, how much equipment payload weight you're going to put on that apparatus after it goes in service. So a couple thoughts. If this is a brand new rig and you don't have an inventory of what's going on there, you need to develop one and get some equipment weight so you have an idea. Are we putting 2,500 pounds on this vehicle? Are we putting 5,000 on? Are we putting 10,000 pounds on? To say you have a rescue vehicle just kind of gives you a framework for where you might be, but you could be anywhere from I'm putting all this stuff and I could put it in the trunk of my Toyota to I could be carrying 12,000 pounds worth of stuff, plus heavy shoring and lumber. So we need to know what equipment is, what fixed and portable equipment is going on there, and the associated weights. To compare your rescue to your last rescue pumper that had a 31,000-pound rear axle, unless this unit has suppression capabilities, you don't have a water tank, so there's a sizable amount of weight that you're not going to have on the vehicle. And even though you had a 27 or 31,000-pound rear axle, the brake sizes don't change. The brake chambers sizes are going to change because they're going to be sized based on the axle. But you could have a situation, and worst case scenario, Mike, based on the question, put a 21.5 front under it and a 31 rear, and then find out after you put your, let's call it 6,000 pounds of equipment on there, you're running around in service, and the thing barely weighs 27,000 pounds on the rear end. Well, now you got tires, springs, and suspension on a back rated for 31. You're going to be bouncing that equipment all over the place because you're way over-axled and oversprung. And I understand that, you know, to our readers and our listeners, and we really appreciate the question, the people are always hesitant to buy an under-axle vehicle, so they're hesitant, so their tendency is going to put the heaviest thing under there that we can. Particularly on a non-walk-in rescue, that, again, with the configuration, if you've got a six-man cab with a big block engine and a lot of stuff like we were talking about, you put all that stuff out on the front bumper, you can find yourself from a weight distribution standpoint. Once you put four or five people in the front, and unless you've got a lot of fixed components and portable equipment sitting over the rear axle or behind it, your weight balance can be off. You can have percentage-wise more weight on the front than you would want and not enough weight on the rear. Now you put the 31,000-pound axle on there, you got the big air cans, and you're glazing the brakes prematurely because you don't have enough weight on the back end. So short answer there, I think we laid down the butt, pushed the guy over to second. We need to have a tool and equipment list and be able to evaluate that. If your manufacturer said we can do it with an 18 and a 27, we'll have them prove it. Give them your equipment weight. They can come back and do a weight analysis based on their design of the vehicle, whether it's an aluminum cab or stainless steel body or whatever you're doing here, roll-up doors or hinge doors, and tell you where the weight distribution is going to be. And then you can make a determination. Can I put more equipment on? Maybe I'm already overloaded, but more importantly, maybe my weight balance isn't too good, and maybe I need to shuffle some equipment around. So there's that one. Okay. So
you're ready to hit a home run, partner.
We're just looking. We're playing small ball here, just looking to move the guy over to third and then maybe hopefully scoring a wild pitch. So we got a guy on second, one out, you know, laid down that butt. What do you got for our third and final question of the day?
It comes from Florida, state of Florida. Dear apparatus architects, I was wondering if you know what the increased cost of fire apparatus are going to be due to the new 2010 EPA engine emission requirements. I've heard that the new requirements will add anywhere between $10,000 and $50,000 to the price of a new apparatus. I am trying to write a justification letter to my city stating why we need to move forward with a purchase, even in these difficult economic times, based on the upcoming changes. Thank you in advance, Michael.
Well, got another last one of the day here. Got another very good question. And we've kind of talked about it a little bit. We'll try to expand on it and wrap up today. On small block diesel engines, and we're talking about things in the 250 to 300 horsepower range, something that if you're looking at, if you're running around in a smaller Navistar or Freightliner cabin chassis that you'd use for a support vehicle or possibly for one of the medium-duty ambulances, initial information there looks like the installed cost of the engine in those units at the low end going to be somewhere like around $8,000 to $10,000, as the listener's question alluded to. You get to the medium block engines that we use a lot of time on the rescue vehicles, on pumpers, things in the area of 330 at the low end to, say, call it maybe 400, 4.25 horsepower range, the medium block engines. I've heard numbers that have been, I think, pretty close, Michael. It looks like they're going to go up somewhere in the area like $15,000 to $22,000 installed cost for those. The unknown that I haven't heard any good numbers on yet, the big block engines, where you go into an apparatus committee meeting and people talk about the engine, say, what's the biggest thing that'll fit there? And you go, 515, great. Okay, next thing. You know, now we're on to discussing things inside the cab. The big block engines looks like a roundhouse number anywhere between 25 to 30, 32,000 installed cost. So it's going to be significant. Unfortunately, and this is what Mike and I have talked about in earlier podcasts, very tragic that you're looking at because of economy and municipal budgets, funding streams. Many, many departments have had their capital projects cut back, if not completely, you know, taken out. And if your department is one where you're looking to be able to bolster up or be able to keep up the staffing levels at what you've been accustomed to run, you know, you've looked at rotational closings, or there's been all kinds of horror stories about, you know, firefighter layoffs and cutbacks. If you're laying off firefighters, chances are your community's not thinking about buying a $400,000 to $500,000 fire truck. And if they are, you know, and you're facing those kinds of things to say, well, you're looking at, you know, the rig could cost another $25,000 or $30,000. The issue is, if the money's not there, the money's not there. If the money's not there, and you were even looking to buy a program pumper, say at the low end for $325,000, and your community couldn't afford that, you know, a basic, you know, triple combination pumper, you know, almost like the least expensive thing you could buy. If you can't afford $300,000 now, to tell your community, say, well, it's only going to be more money next year, they'll look, they're shrugging their shoulders and go, yeah, hey, we know that. You know, I heard a great expression the other day from a gentleman. They were talking about something over the political spectrum, and a guy goes, I'm going to hit you with some facts. He goes, I have a PhD in the totally obvious. Well, that's sometimes, I think, the way that we're coming across to our municipal officials, as we're saying, the price is going to be more next year, and it's going to be worse, and there's more technology. And they're like, thanks for the information, but there's no money. And if there's no money in the coffers, you know, I guess the alternative is you suck it up and you're going to have to wait till next year. If your community has the ability to have a funding stream now, to do it with a combination of a funding stream and a grant that they've applied for, to maybe look at alternative payment structures. Many communities are reticent to look at anything other. We've always paid cash on a barrel head, or they put out a bond, but now their bonding limits are coming up and say, well, you might want to look at a lease purchase arrangement. You know, you can pay for it, you know, when it's delivered, the first payment. You can do it a year in arrears. You can do it over a period of, you know, anywhere from typically from 5, 7 to 10 years. So you can still look at getting the needed equipment without having to have that big single expense dump on your budget line and under the capital items right away. But, you know, the old adage of, you know, it's pay me now or pay me later. If you don't have the funds now, as long as you're the person responsible for the fire department budgeting or working with the chief to let the chief know, okay, we don't have the money now. I'm just telling you now so you can go on record and let the people know. If you had put in your budget, let's take, for example, the $325,000 basic program pumper, didn't have too many frills on it, but it would get you by, all right? And they say, sorry, chief, no money. Come see me next April or May when we're putting the budget together again, and we'll give it a shot. And you can just go on record and say, okay, I'm just telling you right now, that rig, you might as well figure a minimum of 4 to 5% of just normal price increase, plus that additional, you know, throw in the number for the engine that's appropriate, and that rig's going to cost, if it's 5% of even $300,000 plus your engine cost, that same thing next year, Mr. Mayor, that's another 60 or 70 grand. I got to tell you, and the money's not going in my pocket. There isn't anybody making any more money, because the fire truck market, as we've spoken previously, is about where the automotive market is right now. Now, the market is way down. The number of new fire trucks purchased so far in 2009 compared to 2008, depending upon who you talk to and whose numbers you look at, it's off anywhere between a minimum of 30 to 40%. That means there's 30 to 40% less people buying, less fire trucks purchased. That's got to have an impact on something, and it shrunk the market up. It might shrink the prices a little bit, but sooner rather than later, the fire truck industry needs to survive, much like the automotive industry. And when, you know, I'm not going to be going to I had somebody joke with me, Mike, and to finish up the response, said, you know, we had the cash for clunkers program. You know, the government ought to come out with a cash for pumpers program. Well, you know, depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, I don't think the cash for clunkers program was particularly well administrated. I wouldn't want to think about what the hell would happen with people, you know, taking an order for a fire truck and delivering it and then waiting 60 or 90 days for the feds, you know, to pay Mr. Fire Truck Manufacturer A, B, and C the money that he owes them. But nonetheless, to the listeners, it's a tough economic time. We've got to become more innovative probably than we ever had of how to continue to advance and improve our service delivery system, given the practical restraints of, you know, when there's no money in the, you know, in the checking account, you can't write a check. And that's about where we're at. So, Mike, that's my attempt there on getting that guy over to home. But it's a tough financial condition that everybody's in, and it's just something we're going to have to live with for a while until the economy turns around and our tax structure and a lot of other things where municipalities are relied upon their, you know, financial strain to be able to, you know, get a little better to, you know, make our life in a fire service better.
Well, thank you, Tom. I have just one follow-up question. As the third quarter of 2009 is slowly coming to an end, and we head on to the fourth quarter, what are 2009 engine availability as you see it now?
Well, I think most of the builders, Mike, have tried to procure, secure, have a bullpen of engines, so to speak. You know, with the financial, the banking situation the way it is, a lot of the builders, where they're accustomed to having, call it a credit line on the bank that allows them to have the work in process and keep everything flowing. With the way the banking structure is, most banks were not too, happy, or willing, to go just pony up more money. And say, for example, even a small mid-level, apparatus builder's got to have, several millions of dollars on a credit line. I guess the parallel for the listeners can be if you have any kind of credit card. I always get a real joke when I get my monthly statement, and it tells you what my personal credit line is, and I think, my God, if I'd rather spend that much money, and have it in credit, it would be a sad day indeed. But to be able to run a business, I mean, let's just break it down real quick. Let's suppose you build 50 trucks a year, and at any given time, you got 3 to 4 units in production. That's a couple $1 million worth of stuff. Plus, you have to pay your people. You have to pay your payroll taxes. You have to pay for your health insurance, your mortgage on the building, utilities and everything. Small little company, easily, even a small builder, has got to have a $5 to $8 million credit line. Well, now if you're going to start buying engines in the anticipation of what the Wilbur Fire Department or the Shan Fire Department might want in the future, you know, where's that increased line going to come from? A lot of banks aren't going to be willing to pony up the money to be able to do that. So that means the money's got to come from somewhere. So several manufacturers have offered programs that the customer could pre-buy the engine, for a fixed sum of money, typically somewhere between $30,000 to $35,000. You can buy the engine. We'll give you the bill of sale. You own the engine. There's the serial number, and it gives us some time to figure out, the rest of the design of the vehicle, and then more importantly, how you're going to pay for the whole thing when the whole thing is done. Other people can stockpile or have, like as I called it, a bullpen of engines. Detroit diesel engines, probably by the time our listeners hear this podcast, Mike, they're largely going to be spoken for. The Cummins engines are still going to be available for a short period of time. It's unknown to me what the availability of Caterpillars are going to be, probably somewhat nominal at best, because they had indicated that they're pulling out of the emergency services market and not going to have an engine offering for 2010. So, for the listeners, if you are in a position where you can purchase something, the old adage of haste makes waste. If you have a preferred vendor that you're working with, a builder, you want to inquire right up front and say, based on the amount of time you need to put your unit into the bidding process, if it takes 14 days or 21 days, or it's going to take 28 days plus your council doesn't meet until the second Tuesday in November, you probably want to be finding out, and have some degree of assurance. If you're going over all those hurdles, is the engine going to be there for you? The indications are right now, because there hasn't been any significant spurt in third quarter buying, and I don't suspect much in the fourth quarter, as compared to to what happened in 2006 in the anticipation of the 07 emissions things. And again, it's just because of the tightness of the economy. You know, a fire department can sit and look at their budget line, and they know right now whether they got money to buy a fire truck or not. You know, it's not a surprise. So they're either actively engaged, and there are a few out there, Mike, or, you know, they're having to sit on the sidelines and watch the parade go by because there is not an alternative. So,
thank you, Brother Tom.
So Michael, any final thoughts here as we wrap up for today?
Well, again, as you've proven out, the economy, although on some fronts it seems to be getting marginally better, as far as the fire truck industry and apparatus go, we have a very long way to go, and good times are certainly a ways down the road yet, based on what the economy is doing now. So everybody just keep your chin up. We continue to hear about firefighters being laid off, and just some really tough times out there, and we just have to stick together and help each other out so we can get through these times and get back on the other side.
Well, Mike, thanks very much. And to our listeners, if you have any questions that you would like us to answer for you either privately or on the air, you can send them to podcast@firehouse.com. You can also send anything inquiries in to Mike's website, emergencyvehiclerresponse.com, and he'll do his best to get back to you. And until the next time, please, let's keep our heads up, as Mike said, and let's be safe out there. So thanks very much to all our listeners. We'll look forward to seeing you and catching you on the radio here very shortly. For Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, take care, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.